So yesterday we left it off somewhere, you know, Subhuti had asked Lord Buddha, do you think anyone's going to be able to get this later? And Lord Buddha got a little bit upset and said, don't ask questions like that. And then they got into the subject of when the Lord Buddha's teachings are going to end. In the next part of the sutra, Subhuti is asked a question by Lord Buddha. Lord Buddha says, suppose you took a certain number of planets and covered it with precious things. There are seven traditional precious substances like gold, silver, ruby, diamond, things like that. And I want to go to that first, okay? This is from Abhidhammakosha in the third chapter. The third chapter of Abhidhammakosha is about the world. Like where do planets come from? How does this planet start? How did the first beings reach this planet? It's a beautiful chapter, and it describes the end of the planets. It describes how this planet will end, for example, and it describes the supernova of our sun and the gradual burning away of the people, and then the planet, plants, and then all the oceans of this planet, and then eventually it's vaporizing of the planet by the supernova of our sun. And then it gets into distance, the measurement of time and distance. It does distance down to subatomic particles. There's like 16 levels of subatomic particles, and then it goes up to like light years. And it's really amazing. It's an amazing book. But in that, in the Abhidharma, they discuss the idea of galaxies, like how many inhabited planets are there around, okay? So that's relevant to what we're going to talk about today. So I'm going to give you that. Please say, Dong. Chipu. Dong. Chipu. Dong means a thousand. It's also the same spelling in Dongbanyi, which is emptiness, but it's not at all the same word, okay? This Dong means a thousand. Chipu means like a general thousand, meaning a basic thousand. And what this refers to is a thousand inhabited planets. Like, think of Star Trek and a sector of the galaxy, and, you know, once you get to a thousand inhabited planet, that's a Dong Chipu, like one block of outer space which has a thousand inhabited planets in it. It's called a Dong Chipu. And then they describe, it's really cool, what the different planets look like, who's living there, what they do, how people get there, things like that. Okay, so that's a thousand planets, inhabited planets. Say Dong Parma. Dong Parma. Dong again means a thousand. Bar, this is the part in Bardo, it means in between. So Parma means an in-between thousand or a second order galaxy. Okay, it means you take a thousand of these sectors that have a thousand inhabited planets in them, you lump them together, and that's a Dong Parma. Okay? So it's a thousand groups of a thousand planets each. So what's a thousand times? It's a million inhabited planets, okay? Would be called a Dong Parma. And that's actually a sector in Buddhist scripture in the third chapter of the Abhidhammakosha. You guys did in Kathmandu the fourth chapter. What's the connection between the third chapter and the fourth chapter? That's called Tenken Lashak. Tenken Lashak means there's a famous kangyur in Mongolia called Teng Parma. Tengba means the, what do you call the strip across the doorway? Threshold of the door. And Tengbangma means there's, it's the only copy in the world in Mongolia, and you can't take it past the, its name is can't take it past the threshold. And then Lamas and Sarah always say, don't leave your fourth chapter at the Teng of the room in Kathmandu. Okay? I mean, try to carry it past the threshold of the door. Anyway, what's the connection between the third chapter and the fourth chapter? Third chapter describes the planet, our planet, and how the people got here. Fourth chapter describes what? Karma. Who made it? Where did it come from? You said, okay. Then if you take a thousand of those, say, Dong Chenpo. Dong Chenpo. That's a thousand Dong Parmas. Okay? So you take a thousand planets, you draw a line around it, you take a thousand of those groups of planets, that's a Dong Parma, and then you take a thousand of those. So it's a billion planets, okay? it's a group of a billion planets, and there's lots of tongue chumbles hanging around, okay? In Buddhist scripture, they describe all these tongue chumbles, okay? Now Lord Buddha poses a question to Subhuti. He says, if some Rikipuam Rikipumo, which means any man or woman of noble family, that's in the Heart Sutra also. What's a noble family? Bodhisattvas. Tering Sangye Riksuke, Sangye Sese Dagito. You know, you say it every day. Now I joined a new family. Okay, so if any man or woman of noble family, meaning trying to be a bodhisattva, were to take all the planets in a tongue temple, okay, a billion planets, and cover them with diamonds or other jewels. You know, like, we talked about how this park was purchased for Lord Buddha, and they had to cover the park in gold coins, just touching each other, and they had to cover the whole surface of the park. Now imagine a whole planet covered with diamonds. Like, you take one diamond, you set it down, and then you set a diamond next to that, and then you set a diamond next to that, you set a diamond next to that, and you cover the whole planet. Then you take a billion of those planets and cover them with jewels, okay? And then Buddha says, if you offered that to somebody, and then later he clarifies to even an enlightened being, if you took those planets, a billion planets, covered with diamonds, offered them to an enlightened being, would that be a good karma? What do you think, Subhuti? You know, Subhuti says, yeah, I guess so. You know, and actually we call it Pumbo. Would that be a huge mountain of good karma? And he says, yes, it would be. And then Buddha says, why? And he says, because good karma doesn't exist. And piles of good karma don't exist either. You said that. Okay, he's talking to Lord Buddha, and Lord Buddha says, right on, you got it, you know, you figured it out. So then Lord Buddha says, and by the way, if a person were to stand up and take the Diamond Cutter Sutra and take four lines of verse in the Sanskrit and explain it properly to someone, the good karma they make would be infinitely greater than the other person. You couldn't compare them, you know. No comparison, okay? If someone got up in front of somebody else, that's what I was trying to get to last night. If you got up in front of somebody else and taught them four sentences about the meaning of what we've been talking about in the Diamond Cutter Sutra, about emptiness, and you compared that act to covering a billion planets with diamonds and offering it to Lord Buddha, Lord Buddha said, there's no comparison. There's absolutely no comparison. The person that taught somebody as much emptiness as they understood has already created infinitely more good karma than the first person. Okay? Period. And he says that over and over again in this scripture. He keeps saying it over and over again. He even says, okay, so you can't explain it to somebody. Just read it out loud. You still get infinitely more good karma. Oh, so you can't read it. At least hold it, you know, which later he explains to memorize. But anyway, he's just saying, just to be in any way involved in the business of talking about emptiness and thinking about emptiness is infinitely more good karma than making offerings or giving away things or things like that, okay? It's not to say that making offerings is not important, or else every Buddha wouldn't have said it was important. You know what I mean? It's extremely important. But compared to studying emptiness for 15 minutes or something, it just doesn't compare. Okay? Now, what's ideal? Study emptiness and then give you offerings with an understanding of emptiness, and then you're really in business. Okay? So, you know, so also it applies to all the work, you know, anything that's any good karma you can think of, you know, like building statues or building buildings, or those are called Zenle Tuwa Gewa in the Abhidharma. To be involved in the business of making temples, images, dharma centers, anything like that is called Zenle Tuwa Gewa. Zenle Tuwa Gewa means automatic incredible karma. Just be there, just stand around with your hands in your pockets while the other people are digging, you know, is already, due to the nature of the object, is incredible good karma, okay? And then if you can stand there with your hands in your pockets and think about the emptiness of everything, not your pockets, okay? There's like extraordinary virtue. So I'm not saying it's not important to do the other karmas. What I'm trying to say is, get your emptiness done first, charm, and then go do the other virtues with that knowledge of emptiness. Learn to do the perfections with the understanding of emptiness, and then you can't beat that virtue. You know, Dzogchen to Rigyawa, virtue has to do with the physical upkeep and creation of Dharma centers, temples, buildings, and then do it with an understanding of emptiness, and then you're in business. That's why Lord Buddha is talking about that kind of good karma, okay? On what basis can Lord Buddha say that? You know, why? So Buddha comes back with, why? You know, and then he says, because this is how you get Buddhas. You know, those four lines of the diamond cutter is how you make a Buddha, okay? And you got to talk about prioritization, okay? There's a thing called, I can't spell it, so I won't spell it. It's called Mangdom. Say Mangdom. Mangdom. In the Vinaya teachings, there's a thing called Mangdom. Mangdom means a priority conflict. Okay? Like, it's absolutely required as a Drupa Lapa, meaning a positive instruction by Lord Buddha, that you must have a monastic tutor. It's called a Nay Lama. For the first 10 years after you're ordained, you are required to have a senior monk or nun who shows you the ropes. And you're allowed to do two things without their agreement. Brush your teeth and go to the toilet, okay? And anything else, you have to consult them and say, is this a good thing to do? And then they show you the ropes, you know? And you have to be at the side of a great monk or nun to become a great monk or nun for the first 10 years, okay? That's a requirement. So there's a rule that if something happens to your Nay Lama, like they pass away, or they go on a trip, or they can't be there right then, that you are absolutely required immediately to go find a new Nay Lama. You know, that's an instruction of Lord Buddha. You have to. That's what called a Drupa Labdhyam means, a positive instruction. You know, you must go find a new one immediately. Okay, now, he has a Gakwen Labdha, which means a negative instruction at the same time. You cannot miss Sojong. Sojong means every 2 weeks monks and nuns have to get together, sit in a circle, and confess openly what they did wrong to each other so they can help each other, okay? And that's called and you're not allowed to miss that. Now what happens if they're ringing the Gandhi, it's called Gandhi, and they bang this piece of wood a special way. It's just an old gong, you know, and you hold it on your shoulder and you go bang, 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 you know, and you make a special sound. Then everybody's supposed to come to Sojo. So you hear the Gandhi being rung, okay? And then your Nay Lama just left town. So you have a priority conflict here, you know, like it's two virtuous things and you have to decide which one is more important, okay? In this case, you're supposed to still go find your Nay Lama, okay? And miss Sojo. You're allowed to miss Sojo, and you don't break a vow. You see what I mean? The same thing applies to, I think, most people in Dharma centers. You know, most people I meet, my life is sort of unreal because I only meet very good people all day long. You know what I mean? I only meet Dharma students, people trying to be good all day long. You know, no matter how bad I am, they come up to me and apologize. You know, and it's that kind of world. And then those people have different vows and different commitments, and you have to be aware of the priority conflicts. In other words, once I think you're in the Dharma center, and once you're seriously into practicing, it becomes a question of, not of whether you're going to do good deeds or bad deeds, it becomes a question of what's a better good deed to do. You see, what will get you enlightened faster? You know, what will get you to enlightenment quicker? And then you have to make decisions like that. I think your decisions are mostly not, you know, should I steal from the temple here or should I go to Sojong or something like that. It's more like, you know, should I go to Sojong or should I go to this, His Holiness is holding a tantric empowerment. Now which one should I do? And you have to think about priorities, okay? And what the diamond cutter is getting into now is priorities, okay? It's one thing to... It's a good deed to give things to holy beings, and that's an important thing to do. It's much more important to study emptiness. So if you have a priority conflict, if then you should study emptiness. You see what I mean? The karma is infinitely more powerful. Because you're in the business of getting enlightened as fast as you can, and every day you stall, you're hurting other beings, okay? Like, if you were a Buddha, you could help other people a lot better than you can now. So every day you stall, you're letting down other people. So you have to constantly think, you know, our business is not to think, should I do a good thing or should I do a bad thing? It's more like, I got 10 good things I could do now, which one's more important, okay? And emptiness, okay? I have a sort of a rule among my close students. We study till 1 o'clock. We practice, meditate, do our different special practices, and we don't come out till 1 o'clock. We don't answer the phone. We don't meet anybody. Say 1:30. We don't go anywhere, you know. And, you know, people call us up, you know, you could go see the Dalai Lama, it's at 9 o'clock. Say, you have a mind bone, you have a priority conflict. You see what I mean? And you have to decide. Pretty much you have to prioritize your life that way. And I suggest you think about it. You know, Lama Sepa I know does it. Up to a certain time, I believe he just doesn't see anybody. You know what I mean? And I think you should consider doing the same thing. There should be a block of time in your life which is set aside for deep study, deep meditation, deep practices that you do. And emptiness should be on the list, okay? By the way, we're doing emptiness meditation tomorrow morning, 10:30. And then that's something you can use to study emptiness. So if you want, bring a tape recorder or something like that, okay? And we'll go through a guided meditation on emptiness, okay? Okay. It's okay. Can you? So I wanted to... What Lord Buddha is talking about here is the act of giving, actually. And he's getting into the six perfections. I thought it'd be nice to have a little spiel on the six perfections. I know you're supposed to know them, and I know that a lot of people don't know them very well, and I thought it'd be nice to go through the six perfections, okay? What makes them perfections, I'll get into later. We talked about it a little bit before, and I'll talk about it more later. The perfection of Jimba, which is giving, okay? The perfection of giving gets you enlightened very fast. Plain old giving without the perfection doesn't get you enlightened very fast. Okay, so we have to talk later during this class about the difference. We spoke a little bit about it before, and we have to talk about it again. Okay, there are four basic kinds of giving, okay, that you can follow. And I'm not going to write the Tibetan because we don't have much time, but the first one is called Sang Sing, which means material things. Giving food, giving money, giving place to stay, clothing, all kinds of material things, okay? Sang Sing Jimba. Second one is Ninjipa, which means protection. Protection can be many different kinds. I mean, obviously, if someone's getting mobbed or hurt or something like that, you protect them. You help them. But it can also mean if you know somebody who's depressed, somebody who's lost a relative, died, or other kinds of mental problems that people need to be protected from. The Tibetan means to save from fear. And it means to save from all the physical dangers of the world and all the mental dangers of the world, and that's the giving of protection, okay? Third one is giving of Dharma, okay? And this is the difference between giving somebody a fish and teaching them to fish, you know what I mean? That's the real difference. I mean, it's good to give people money. It's good to save people who are in trouble, but if you could teach them, for example, how to do refuge, what does it mean to go for refuge, okay? Like the real meaning of refuge. I was at this temple there, and Buddham Saranam Rajami, and I said, do you know what that means? They said, no. Anyway, going for refuge, the real meaning of it is a long story, but it is to do an act with an understanding of emptiness. All three of the jewels, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, are intimately tied up with emptiness. The Buddha jewel as opposed to Buddha. The Buddha jewel is mainly the essence body, which is what? The emptiness of the Buddha, okay? And the Dharma jewel, as opposed to general Dharma, is the direct perception of emptiness. And the real Sangha that you go to refuge, the Sangha refuge, is defined as people have seen emptiness directly. Are we seeing a pattern here? Okay. There's always, you teach somebody to understand where their problems are coming from. You teach them to understand why they don't have enough money. And they're home free. You see, if you understand emptiness, you understand the key to the occurrence of every phenomenon in the world. You see what I mean? And it's very, very interesting. You know, I was in Hong Kong teaching businessmen the key to reality. You know, I'm sitting there teaching them emptiness because they want to make more money. You know, and of course the idea is to get them into Dharma sooner or later, but it actually works for whatever you want to use it for. You know what I mean? It works. The Buddha described how reality works. If you understand the key to how reality works, you can make anything happen. You see what I mean? And people say, prove it, you know? And then, you know, in Hong Kong they said, prove it. And I said, look up, what do you call it? There's a company that reviews other companies. Standard & Poor's or something. So I said, look up my company in Standard & Poor's. You know, I don't own the company, okay? I gave away all my shares. Sarah got a bunch of buildings, and that's okay. But, you know, we started with three people. Now we have about 1,000. Key to reality. You know, I'm sitting there teaching them emptiness because they want to make more money. You know, and of course the idea is to get them into Dharma sooner or later, but it actually works for whatever you want to use it for. You know what I mean? It works. The Buddha described how reality works. If you understand the key to how reality works, you can make anything happen. You see what I mean? And people say, prove it, you know? And then, you know, in Hong Kong they said, prove it. And I said, look up, what do you call it? There's a company that reviews other companies. Standard & Poor's or something. So I said, look up my company in Standard & Poor's. You know, I don't own the company, okay? I gave away all my shares. Sarah got a bunch of buildings, and that's okay. But, you know, we started with three people. Now we have about 1,000 people. And it's 100 million plus a year. Because you understand the how things work. You really understand how things work. You can make anything work the way you want it to work if you understand Dharma. So it's much more viable to give somebody Dharma than to give them money or food or anything else. You teach them the key to the universe, then they can make the universe whatever they want. You see what I mean? So if you have to compare any kind of these two to this one, there's no comparison. That's what the Lord Buddha is talking about. If you understood what the Diamond Cutter Sutra meant, you could manipulate your reality into whatever you want, period. And manipulate, I'm not saying bad. I'm saying you could create any reality you want. That's what tantric practice is all about. That's what tantra is the practice of creating a different reality. And if you know if you know emptiness and the six perfections, you're home free. You can make anything happen that you want to happen. You know, anything you wish to happen, you can bring about. And that's just like, it's like what mankind has searched for all these years, you know. You can actually control your life and your destiny and what happens to you. And you can create a perfect world, okay? And that's, so to teach someone how to do that is very powerful. Okay, last one. Last one is love. And really, it comes after Dharma because if you knew the secret to the universe, but you didn't care about anybody else, you just sit there and hog it yourself. You know what I mean? Okay? So, love implies this deep concern for other people. and the desire that they get what they want, okay, and practicing giving that way. That's the first perfection, okay? This is obviously the most powerful one, giving the Dharma, okay? Yeah, I'm thinking. Forms. See you? He said forms. That's, no, not forms. D&B, Dun & Bradstreet. Okay. Say sitting. Sitting. Sitting means living an ethical life, okay? And there are three forms of it, okay? Very basically. One is what we call freedom vows. In Sanskrit, that's called pratimoksha. Prati means individual, moksha means free. And they say, why do you call individual freedom? And Lord Buddha says, if you keep on, you get free. If you don't, you don't. It's an individual matter. Okay? Prati moksha. Okay? This is the subject of the Vinaya. You know, a lot of people say Vinaya is monk's vows or nun's vows or something like that. It's not true. There's eight different sets of vows, three for lay people, five for ordained people, okay? And then two other commitments. So really, it's a code of life for both lay people and ordained people, okay? The emphasis of the pratimoksha vows is your individual freedom. You know, you get to nirvana, which is what? The end of your mental afflictions due to what you understood after you saw emptiness directly. So, okay? So the main emphasis of these vows is to get you into nirvana. And the main emphasis of the vows is the lumaki din, means the four good deeds of your body and three good deeds of speech. Okay? Respecting life, respecting other people's things, sexual purity. Always telling the truth, trying to bring people together with your speech, trying to always say something meaningful, and always speaking gently to other people. Okay, those are the main emphasis of the pratimoksha. It all boils down to trying not to hurt other people. Okay. That's how Jeton Kapa described it. It's keeping the seven and their basis, which he describes as the last three of the ten good deeds. Okay? What is that? Happy when other people get things. Sorry, no. Yeah, happy when other people get things, sad when other people don't get things, and then correct worldview. Having a good worldview. Okay. Second one is bodhisattvas. And they build on each other, okay? You keep your bodhisattva vows well if you're based on pratimoksha vows. You see what I mean? So you're grounded by your pratimoksha vows. Your foundation is your pratimoksha vows. And then you pile on top of that. On top of that, you build your bodhisattva vows, okay? And bodhisattva vows are 64 primary, you know, 18 and 46? Yeah. To do, anyway, 64 vows plus a bunch of other commitments that they don't usually tell you about, okay? And those are 64 bodhisattva vows. These have a different flavor. Dr. Shimmer, Chinnamurti Singh, like, don't praise your Dharma center and put down other Dharma centers, you see what I mean, or other faiths, you see what I mean? Chinnamurti Singh, don't fail to give away Dharma to people who need it, and don't fail to give away material things to other people. So you can feel the difference. Here it's more like, trying to live the Bodhisattva ideal, okay, of taking care of other people. The goal here is to get yourself into an enlightened paradise and to help other people get there, okay? And then the third kind of morality would be tantric vows, okay, keeping your tantric vows. And the goal, the emphasis of the tantric vows is to be quick within one lifetime, okay? To get enlightened within one lifetime. And that's the emphasis of tantric vows. The difference between tantric vows and bodhisattva vows is mainly a question of speed. Okay, it's a decision to do it in this lifetime, okay? And again, it's built on the bodhisattva vows. You have to have bodhisattva vows to take tantric vows, and in fact, in some of the lower tantric groups or schools, bodhisattva vows are your tantric vows, okay, with a certain kind of twist to them, okay? So, these are the three kinds of vows. They are built on each other. Okay, to think that you don't need paramita vows to have to do your bodhisattva vows well is, Jetsun Kapa said, that's the equivalent of destroying the entire barley harvest of Tibet in 1 year. You know what I mean? To think that thought is the equivalent of destroying everybody's food in the whole country. You know, that bodhisattvas don't need paramita vows, and that tantric practitioners don't need those other two kinds of vows. Okay, he said that just to think that thought is as evil as destroying the food supply of all Tibet for a year. You know, he said something like that. But if you have a nangdom, what do? You see, then if you have a priority conflict, you go for the higher vow. Okay, so it's tantric practitioners keep their pratimoksha vows better than people who are only keeping pratimoksha vows. But when there's a priority conflict between keeping a pratimoksha vow and keeping a tantric vow, you are required not to keep the pratimoksha vow. And Jetsun Kapa says, from that action, you not only don't break a vow, you collect infinite good karma. He says it specifically like that, okay? And he's very careful to say it's not like you broke the lower vow to keep the higher vow. By keeping the higher vow, you honor the lower vow, and that's an incredibly good karma, okay? So you don't have to think of it like a bad, you know, two bad choices or something like that, okay? That's morality. One more thing to say about morality. People ask me, a lot of people come up to me and say, I've been Dharma practitioner for 10 years, I've been trying to meditate, and it's not going so good, you know? And I say, do you know the most common problem is, do you know the preliminary steps, the seven preliminary steps? We'll do them tomorrow, by the way, in the morning. And I say, yeah, I do know how to do them. I do them properly. So then I say, then maybe you want to check your morality. Okay, are you keeping your vows? You see, I mean, that's supposed to be the most common cause of problems in your meditation. And people don't say that much. Jetsun Kapa was really big on it. The most common reason why people have trouble meditating is that they're probably overlooking one of their vows. Okay? They're probably not keeping one of their vows nicely. Okay? Finally, I ask you not to think of vows as vows. Don't think of them as promises. Don't think of them as some kind of obligation. I met a great, there's a great Nima Western monk named Matthieu Ricard. He says vows are like wings. You know, somebody asked him, isn't it a big hassle to be a monk? He said, no, it's like wings to have those vows, you know. And really the vows are just a list of the most powerful good karmas you can do to turn this empty cylinder into Manjushri Lotara's arm in this, in your lifetime. So don't ever think of them as some kind of obligation or some pain in the ass thing that you have to keep these stupid rules, you know. It's not rules. It's a list of suggestions from Lord Buddha of how to get this cylinder to turn into Manjushri's arm as fast as possible. And you should love them, you should cherish them, you should feel excited. Like when your favorite song comes on the radio, how you feel. You know what I mean? When you see your next vow, you know, on your book, you should feel like that. You know, you should feel this excitement. You know, you should feel turned on. Say, oh wow, another vow. Oh wow, you know, start panting, you know. And no, I mean, if you don't feel that way, you don't understand that these are the things that make this empty thing turn into my juicy arm. That's the only thing that will work, you know. So it's like how I feel when I see certain kinds of ice cream, you know. It's just this. Somebody puts it out in a bowl, and I know it's for me, you know, I'm the llama, you know, and I get the first one, and I'm like, you know, and it's this feeling you have, like, good, you know, like this anticipation, you know, and you talk about, you know, and you got all these vows, and you, no, really, it's like, I don't know, it's like, they do like acid or LSD, and, you know, if you took them the right way, they just change your whole reality. You know what I mean? Like, I tried mescaline when I was a kid in this desert canyon, you know, and all these amazing things happened. And I said, I'm going to find out how to make this happen without the mescaline, you know? So it took like 30 years. But, really, it's something like that. You take the vows, and then this thing happens to your reality. But the difference is it stays that way. Somebody asked me yesterday an interesting question. If everything is a projection, then if I take LSD and I see, you know, Buddha for half an hour and then I come down, then isn't that just as real as what you're describing? You know what I mean? And it's very interesting that the highest Buddhist school, Madhyamika Prasangika, has a fight with the lower Madhyamika school, which is called Madhyamika Svatantrika. And they have a disagreement about the status of mistaken perceptions, you know? Like, they call Lope Kunzop and Yamba Kunzop, okay? These are two kinds of normal perceptions, okay? One person is on LSD and sees, you know, pink elephants running through the room, you know? And the other person is not on LSD and just sees dogs running through the room, okay? Now, you know, you might think that because of what I said about projection so far, that they are both equally real. You see what I mean? And the lower Madhyamika school has they're careful to say there's mistaken normal reality where you're seeing purple elephants because you took a drug, and then there's unmistaken normal reality where you see dogs running by, okay? And then the higher Madhyamika school says the guy who took the drug is seeing the elephants because of his karma. His karma is forcing him to see these purple elephants. You know, he took the drug, but it's his karma. The drug is what we call the what's it called? Not really an idea. Hengi chicken. It's a contributing factor, but the perception of the of that that's a long story. Anyway, the perception is caused by your karma. Okay, so in a way, the guy who sees dogs is seeing dogs because of their karma. The guy who sees pink elephants is seeing pink elephants because of their karma. The higher school of Madhyamika refuses to make a distinction between their validity. On one level, okay, they agree that the guy who's seeing pink elephants will not be crushed by them. Okay, they agree that when he comes down, his foot won't be all bloody and smashed, okay, when the dog stepped on his toe. But if you think about it, he had the karma to see a pink elephant, and the other guy had the karma to see a dog, and in that sense, they're both having the same thing going on. And they're both mistaken. Okay? Because they both believe that it's coming from its own side. Okay? So you gotta make that distinction. What I mean to say is, you can have the karma to want to think of your llama as a Buddha. You can have the karma to try to think of your llama as a Buddha. You can have the karma to believe that your llama could be a Buddha. And you can have the karma to just wake up one morning and look at them and they are a Buddha. You see what I mean? And those are all different karmas. It's not to say that number four is the same as number one. You'd rather be in a world of number four than in number one. You'd rather be at second tantric level than first tantric level. Okay? Something like that. But they both have similar causes, okay? And you'd rather have number four than number one, okay? All right. Thank you. Say sopa.
Sopa.
Sopa means, it's been translated as forbearance or patience. I like to call it the art of not getting angry when things are hard, okay? But what it basically means is that when something happens that you could get angry about, you don't get angry, okay? And you have to study it for a long time. And by the way, it can be animate things or inanimate things. So sopa applies to people who irritate you, and sopa applies to being sick in Bodh Gaya, and sopa applies to traffic jams and bad roads and things like that. Okay, sopa means the art of not getting upset about that, not getting angry about that. Okay, I'll just give you a taste of what it would be to do sopa with an understanding of emptiness. Okay, a taste of what it would mean to do sopa with an understanding of emptiness. And I give the same example all the time because I struggled with this for 16 years in corporate life, okay? How to deal with the management, you know, how to deal with your boss, okay? And I did it for 16 years. I had a special relationship, you know, I was one of the founders, I didn't own the company, and the two other founders were husband and wife, and they used to fight all the time, and they used to give me opposite instructions. And then when I didn't do it one said, then the other one would get mad. And when I didn't do it, the other one said, then the one would get mad. And you've probably been in a similar situation somewhere. It's called work. Okay, but, it's like, I give the example, you know, I used to go to a lot of Dharma things. I give the example, you know, I used to go to a lot of Dharma things. Like, I used to run away to the monastery and study for a month. And they would call in the instructions to Madhugiri, which is like a 3-hour drive, because it was the only international phone connection at the time. And I had to drive 3 hours to find out what diamonds I was supposed to buy. And then I had to order them from Belgium and Israel on this crappy little phone in Madhugiri, you know. And anyway, then sometimes things would mess up, you know, and I'd go back to New York, and I remember one real situation. I bought 100,000 carats, which is a lot of diamonds, okay, and the guy, the boss runs in and starts screaming at me, you know. I'm sitting in this diamond sorting room. Diamond sorting rooms look like this, and there's these benches on the side, and the door is here, and then the vase is over here, you know, and nobody can get, there's another door here, and there's another door here, and then there's another door here and here, and, you know, you can get through this door, and but this one has to be closed before this one will open, and then this one has to be closed before this one will open, and then you get in here, and you have to have a special card to get into this one, and then you can get in, and then there's just diamonds all over the tables, and then there's about, you know, 16 people sitting there, and it's dark, the whole room is dark, because you can't see the colors properly if it's not controlled, and everyone has a special wavelength fluorescent light, and you sit in there with these special tweezers with needle tips on them, and you pick up the diamonds and you bring them up to your eye like that, and then you throw them in the good pile or the bad pile, and you have to do like 10,000 a day, you have to go like this, you know. And it's a sphinx. So I'm sitting here, and it's very quiet. All you can hear is the pitter-patter of the stones falling on the table. It's like, you know. So it's very quiet, it's very meditative. I used to really enjoy it, you know. And you're just sitting there quietly. So in breaks the boss, and he's like very angry, you know. And he's like, you bought 100,000 carats, are you crazy, you know. And I'm like, you know, and I'm like, no, I did what you told me to do. You called me, money gave me, March 3rd, I have it in my diary. You planning what this is goddamn this morning, you know. I know you didn't, I didn't tell you that. I told you to buy 10,000 carats, you know. Are you crazy? You're going to bankrupt the company, you know. And so there used to be this guy named Kishan, and here's me, you know. And then here's, we won't name them, they're buyer number 3, okay. And, Kishan likes me because I found him in a field in Gujarat State tending oxen. Now he's the biggest buyer in diamonds in New York City. And buyer number 3 doesn't like me. and then here's me. Now the boss comes in and starts screaming. Now technically speaking, it's only a bunch of cylinders and decibels, right? Technically, you know that. You know, scientifically speaking, it's just, when you talk about the cylinder, it's really just a bunch of cylinders, spheres, colors, red sphere, red long thing, you know. And then there's consonants and vowels, and there's decibels going up and down, you know. Well, really, technically, that's the raw data. That's what we call doc sheet. Doc sheet means the basis of imputation, okay? Which I hate those words. Anyway, it's the raw data, okay? Raw data has just walked in the room, okay? And then I have, from my past, you know, bad karma. I have bad karma in my mind, okay? As a bachad. Bachad means it's dormant in my subconscious, okay? It just rose up to the conscious mind. And you can think of it as rose-colored glasses, or in this color, you know, in this case, crud-colored glasses or something. Anyway, so it's making me interpret these decibels and objects as something very bad. You know, I'm being forced by my karma to interpret this object as something undesirable, which is the definition of bad karma. Okay? Is bad karma that which hurts others? No. Is bad karma that which Buddha said you can't do? No. Is bad karma that which God or your country or your government or your early school teachers or your parents or your priests told you is bad? No. Bad karma is only bad because of one thing. It hurts you later. It gives you a bad result later. It causes you Rangin Namingu Debu, you didn't know what Debu na Langema. Definition. Okay? Any action which as a result later, karmically, brings you an unpleasant consequence is bad karma. Okay, so I'm having, because I interpret this object as unpleasant, I'm experiencing the result of bad karma. Okay? Kish likes me and he's sort of on my side, you know, he's sort of also seeing something sort of bad going on. I forgot to draw Doma, okay? Doma is a Tibetan woman who worked there for like 10, 15 years, okay? And then bio number three is seeing Michael Roach finally get what he deserves. You see what I mean? Bio number three is happy. Bio number three is the one who had to cover me while I was wandering around at Sarah, going to His Holiness's teachings, etc. You know, being in 1 or 2 month retreats. He's the one who had to do double work. And now he's finally hoping he'll get a promotion over me, which he should have gotten a long time ago. You know, so he's like, he's saying something pleasant, okay? He's saying something pleasant. He's seeing a righteous boss giving a righteous, you know, yelling to someone who's made a serious mistake that could hurt the company, okay? So he's actually having the result of what kind of karma? Good karma, okay? Because the definition of good karma is anything that creates for you, over the long run, karmically, a pleasant result is good karma. Now, is it good karma for him to enjoy my pain? No, that's new karma. I'm talking the result of old karma is good. The new karma he's making is bad. We have to distinguish between those two, okay? Now, here's Droma. Droma's sitting over here. She could care less. She just wants the room to be quiet. She has to produce her quota today. If there's not 5,000 stones over there and 5,000 stones over there, she's going to get in trouble. And now this boss is breaking the atmosphere in the room, you know? And so she's having what we call a neutral karma, okay? She just has white noise. It's just background noise, okay? So there's three different people having three different perceptions of one bag of colors and shapes and decibels, okay? That's the emptiness of the boss, okay? That's the emptiness of the boss. What's this got to do with patience? What's this got to do with not getting angry? It's the painting about the boss, so who cares? He can't be good from his own side or else I'd be having a good time. He can't be bad from his own side or he'd be having a bad time. He can't be good or bad from his own side or she'd be having a good and a bad time. Okay? Each person is interpreting the same object in a different way. The object is, in reality, a different object for three different objects to three different people. But what is it really? That's emptiness, okay? Oh, he sees it as bad. He sees it as good. She sees it as neutral. But what is it? Bunch of decibels. A bunch of shapes. Okay? You gotta get used to that. Okay? There is no it. That's what the hard truth is about. Fruitment, diamond, teammate, woman, intimate, timid, okay, this don't exist, this don't exist, this don't. Of course it exists. Of course the boss is there, he's yelling. But a bad boss, a good boss, and a medium boss doesn't exist from his side. Because if he did, then one of us would be experiencing something different. And that's the emptiness of the boss. Okay, what's that got to do with entering tangible paradise in this lifetime? If you answer me right, you get to stop for refreshments. What's it got to do with, you know, what you and I want, which is not to meet those bosses anymore? Okay? Yeah, how you react to it. How you react to it, okay? If you can understand his emptiness at that moment, which is impossible at the beginning, okay? There's always this time lapse. You will remember emptiness. This is where I used to remember it. Guess what this is? This is the coffee, and this is the bathroom. And I used to remember emptiness about here. Okay? Hey, I'm not kidding. After I got mad at him and yelled back at him, then going out the door, he would leave to his, you know, penthouse suite, and I would go to the bathroom, and right around here I'd remember his emptiness and what I should have done. And then, I'm not kidding, the gap is shorter, you know? It goes back. If you keep practicing, then after like a 6 months or something, at the moment you can shut down the anger. You see, I mean, anger only gives you a 3-second lead time. Desire gives you usually an hour build up or a month build up, okay? But anger, you got 3 seconds to do or not to do, okay? And the gap was shortened, okay? That's the whole goal. Don't expect great results of being. The gap was shortened. The gap will go back to here. But what is the gap? Okay, just think of him as empty. What's that mean? And then you're going to say to yourself, you got 2 seconds left, right? Why the hell am I supposed to think of him as empty? Oh yeah, he appears good to that guy, he appears neutral to that lady, and he appears bad to me. And in himself, in and of himself, he's just a bunch of noises and shapes, you know? And my karma is forcing me to see him as a guy who's yelling at me, okay? My karma's forcing me to see it. You got 1 second left, right? And it's like, why do I get that karma? You know? And then you say, because I yelled at somebody in the past. Now we're down to 0 seconds, right? Really? You're down to 0 seconds, and you're thinking, now what should I do back to him if I want to get rid of him? That's good. Okay, just shut up. Don't answer. All right? No, that is the use of emptiness in getting to your tantric paradise. Okay, that's it. That's all you need to know. Now you just have to keep your books. Okay? That is the value of knowing emptiness, and that makes it the perfection of patience, instead of just playing, being a nice guy and trying not to say anything, okay? This is done by an intelligent, trained Buddhist. You know, man or woman, ordained or not, doesn't matter. This is the perfection of patience, you know, because you know how to use the computer, and you're not just sitting there typing numbers and you don't know how to turn it on or off. You see what I mean? You understand how reality works. I refuse to answer to you, not because it's noble, not because the Dalai Lama told us to, you know, but because it will hurt me if I do it. And I don't want to see you like that anymore. I'd rather have you come in and tell me, you bought the 5,000 carats, it was so great, you know, you saved the company, you know. His emptiness is that he could have come in and said either one, you get it? His emptiness is that he could have come in and said either one. He could have come in and given me a promotion. He could have come in and yelled at me. There's an emptiness to what's going to happen in the next 5 minutes. It's empty. It depends on what's going on in your mind. It depends on what karma is in your mind. He could go either way. He could go promotion or fired. Okay? Really. Neither one is fixed at all. Whatever karma you put in your mind is going to come back out. Okay? And that's how you use emptiness. That's a real example. And I'll tell you frankly, okay, I'm not like bragging, and I'm not very good at it. And I'm even being not very good at it, I was able to turn 800 people into beautiful people. You know what I mean? I'm not very good at it. But when I left that company, we were all crying for days. You know, I mean, we were like tight, you know what I mean? And there wasn't, I don't think there was a single person, there was not a single person in a 9-story building that I didn't feel like was really beautiful. You know, and that wasn't because they were beautiful, right? It's just because I tried to keep doing this. And I did it maybe one time out of 10. So, I mean, and I like to dream about what would have happened if I'd done it better. You know, like maybe it would just have been a 9-story Chakrasamvara mandala or something. You see what I mean? I'm not kidding. I'm not kidding. If you can use emptiness just a little bit, you start to get like these extraordinary results in your life. Just a little bit, okay? Because it's so powerful. If you can, one time out of 10, getting irritated with somebody, if you can think about, briefly, about their emptiness, which is the perfection of patience, your life will change so radically that you will want to do it more. You see what I mean? Your life will change so noticeably that you will understand immediately, oh, this is happening because I understand emptiness. And then you get on a roll, and the end of that roll is tantric paradise, okay? Have some refreshments, okay? 5-10 minute break. If you have a question, you want to talk about something, just barge in up here, okay? All right. Somebody bought my favorite candy from the U.S. yesterday. Say, Tsundu. Tsundu. Tsundu is perfection number 4. I think the only thing to say here is defined by Master Satyadeva as Sunkange Latro, means, what is Tsundu? It's having a good time doing virtue. You know, have a good time. And I think when you're in a Dharma center where they have Tsundu, or where people are really doing Tsundu, there's a feeling about it. There's almost a party feeling. I like to call it a Dharma party. You know, U.S., if anybody wants to clean up the dishes, and everyone's like, yeah, yeah, I'd love to clean up the dishes. You know what I mean? And there's none of this like grumbling or grumpy or anything like that. If you really understand Tsundu, people translate it as effort or something like that. My lama used to say, the guy next door works on his car all day. Does he have Tsundu? You know, Tsundu means to work hard at your Dharma stuff because you understand what its value is and you enjoy it and you get high on it. And you have to try to get that feeling about your Dharma practice. It has to be like some kind of party, like a Dharma party. And every time you do it, it's like, they call it a continual Christmas. It's like Christmas every morning, you know what I mean? And you're just, wow, you know, wow, yeah, yeah, I get to build a stupa for Lama Sopa, yeah, yeah, really cool, you know? And you feel like it's an honor, and you feel like excited about it, or something like that. And if you're in a Dharma group where everybody has Tsundu, you know, the only problem you really have is the landlord. We've been thrown out of so many buildings and hotels for, you know, 30 people crushing into a room and getting out a new book or something. You know what I mean? And making a lot of noise. You know? We get thrown out of many places. Okay. Anyway, that's Tsundu. Say Samten. Samten. Samten means the ability to meditate. Okay? The ability to get into a deep state of meditation. The highest form of it, the form that you need to see emptiness directly, okay? And we're going to talk about that more tonight, and you must come tonight, okay? Nobody should miss tonight. Then you can skip the rest of your life, okay? But you got to come tonight, okay? To see emptiness directly, you have to be able to get into a deep state of meditation. It's a special state. It's called Samden Dhamma Nyodo Mito Me. It has a special name. You know, the whole meditative spectrum has thousands of lines on it. It's only one of them that you have to reach to see emptiness directly, okay? And that's a form of shamatha, okay? I thought I'd give you the definition of shamatha from the scriptures, and then when we get to wisdom, I'll give you the definition of vipassana, okay? And I do that partly because there's a lot of misconceptions going on about it, and I thought it'd be nice if you knew what shamatha, the definition of shamatha, okay? So it's like this. I'll just read it, okay? That single-mindedness, okay, that single-pointed state of mind, if you want, which is imbued with exceptional bliss, practiced ease. Practiced ease is a I don't know, it's kind of a hard translation, but it means by doing something over and over again, you get good at it, and then you feel happy when you do it, and that's called xinjiang. Xinjiang can be physical or mental, you know. It's like the first time you ride a horse, it's very painful the next day. After you're very good at riding a horse, it feels like a real pleasure to feel the same, because you know how to move with it and things like that. And that's called xinjiang, okay? Practice ease. Due to the deep single-pointed meditation, on this object. It just means this. To meditate until you get to a point where you have physical and mental pliancy or some kind of very high ability to maintain that, and it becomes a pleasure. It becomes a great pleasure to you. And there's even a bodhisattva vow not to get distracted by the pleasure of it, you see? And when you reach that, that's the definition of shamatha. Basically, think of shamatha as a deep state of meditation in which physically and mentally you're just wired. You know, you can do it as long as you want, you can focus as long as you want, you're used to it, you're good at it, and you're just, your mind is very strong, okay? When we talk about the basis or the platform of meditation that you have to be able to get to see emptiness directly, we'll tell you more about it tonight, okay? Sanden Dhamma Nyodo Mito Me, that special state of meditation that you need to see emptiness directly, okay? It mostly involves being able to shut down your sense powers completely, okay? Like, if you were in Sanden Dhamma Nyodo Mito Me and somebody came in with french fries, you wouldn't smell them. If somebody played your favorite song next to you, you wouldn't hear it, okay? Something like that. That's the level of meditation you have to be able to get to. Sorry? Oh, that's a good question, okay? You asked it, not me, okay? She says, what's the perfection aspect here? I mean, what's the difference between meditation and the perfection of meditation? How do you apply the boss thing to meditation? Okay? Then you go back to the three spheres, okay? And I'll do the three spheres again. Say, Jinjie. Jinjie is in the example of giving. Jinjie means the person giving the stuff. Remember the example? I held out the pen to Rob, and that makes me the Jinjie. The Jinjie means the giver. In the sense of the fifth perfection, it refers to the meditator, the person meditating, okay? So the first step of doing the fifth perfection with an understanding of emptiness is to think about doing the emptiness to reflect briefly, okay, on the fact that you are empty, okay? On the fact that you are empty. Now, what does that mean exactly? We talked about it the other day. If you think about it, you're just listening to your thoughts, okay? If you think about it, can you control your thoughts, really? Are you the one saying the thoughts, or are you the one listening to the thoughts, and is there a time lag between, okay? I mean, most scriptures say there has to be a time lag between the object and the subject, meaning the object has to be there first, you become aware of it, and then the awareness is generated a millisecond after the sense perception is generated, okay? The awareness of what you see is generated a millisecond after the seeing, okay? So in a sense, who's talking to you? You see, I mean, who is it that's saying things to you? That's also just sounds. And then you are organizing those sounds into someone talking to you in your mind. It's the same thing as looking at the pen, and it's the same thing as looking at the boss. And your past karma is forcing you to organize those sounds in your head into a thought. And that's the emptiness of the meditator. Okay? You have to think like that. It's very amazing. You see, why are you not applying objects? Okay? Okay, did everybody hear that? Not bad. Okay, the same rules apply. It's still a projection, okay? That would be the emptiness of the person struggling to meditate, okay? Say, Jinyu means the person you are giving the thing to, okay? Rob. I'm giving him, I'm the Jinjin, he's the Jinyu, okay? In the case of meditation, the object you're trying to meditate on, okay? Like, let's say, a form of Lord Buddha, okay? Trying to see Lord Buddha's picture in your mind, okay? What's the emptiness of that? Whether you have clarity or not, it all depends on your past karma, okay? You are trying to see that. By the way, what does clarity mean in meditation? Does it mean how sharp the arm is? What's clarity mean during meditation? The absence of chinga, okay? The absence of dullness on one side, which is characterized by eating too much and not sleeping enough, and the absence of thinking about too many things on the other side, which is caused by, you know, attraction to the objects of the senses. So the whole idea of equilibrium or clarity means it refers to a bright-eyed, bushy-tailed state of mind. You know, happy, alert. You can call it alertness. You see, it doesn't refer to how clear is the picture. You see what I mean? It refers to how alert is your mind. How well balanced away from the two extremes of thinking about other things or spacing out and getting dull. How well are you riding on the fence, you know? And it's like driving a car. It's like this. Okay, all the time you're correcting. Okay, if you watch a person's hands while they're driving, you never reach a state. That's like some high level of meditation where you don't have to correct anymore. Then it becomes a problem to correct, by the way. But it's like this. It's like this correction all the time. So the clarity of the object, okay, meaning, can you, let's say the object, can you bring the object to mind well? You know, do you have that? That's also a projection, okay? Whether or not you're seeing a Buddha, whether or not you're even on the object you're supposed to be, to reflect that your meditation is going well or your meditation is not going well because of the good or bad you've done to other people in the past. You know, people take pills, people sleep, people don't sleep, people use different cushions, people get colder, people get hotter, people put their head up, people put their head down, people put their elbows like this, people put their elbows like that. It has nothing to do with it. You can say any way you want if your karma is good enough, right? Okay? I mean, it matters, all right? But what I'm saying is that the emptiness of your meditation is that it's also a projection, just like the pen, okay? There's thoughts going through your mind, and whether or not they get organized into a good meditative session or not is only depending on your past karma and how your past karma forces you to interpret the thoughts going through your mind. That's all. It's really interesting. So that's how you use emptiness in meditation, okay? We had a third element, didn't we? So Jinja, you can read two ways, okay? Sometimes it means the thing you're giving in perfections that involve some kind of material passing hands and things like that. But more often it refers to the event, okay? The giving, okay? The whole event of giving going on. That's the third element. That also is empty. In the case of meditation, how did this meditation seed come to be here? How did I come to be sitting on the meditation seat? How did I come to be having the instructions from Lama Sepa to meditate on this object? You know, how did this whole situation occur? Who brought me to this place? And who brought the thing to meditate on to this place? And how is this whole thing happening? You know, what's the karma going on there? And is it happening from its own side or not? Okay, that's a reflection on the emptiness of the meditation event itself, okay? And those are the three kinds of reflection you'd have to do, okay? By the way, in the case of the boss, if you are practicing patience with an understanding of the boss's emptiness, you can quickly turn your entire company into a bunch of really beautiful people. Okay? Seriously. All the bad ones will leave, retire, get fired, or have heart attacks. Okay? I always tell my friends, the American Post Office, you know, the way they get rid of bad employees is to shoot each other. I say, you don't have to do that. You know what I mean? You just understand emptiness. You do the perfection of patience towards them, and they will either change or they will go away. And I'm not kidding. It works. I mean, if that's the only thing Buddhism is good for, it's worth it. Okay? Cleaning out your office. You know what I mean? And Really, it works. I swear it works. Just try it, okay? For meditation, if you're aware of the emptiness of the object, aware of your own emptiness, aware of the emptiness of the whole situation that you're meditating today, your meditation will start taking off. Why? Master Sandy Davis said, nobody asks questions about karma until something bad happens. Now, nobody sits there and pulls their hair out because they got a raise. Well, why me? You know what I mean? Okay, nobody says that. Okay. It's actually his deep teachings on emptiness come in the patience chapter. Because you're supposed to be examining the emptiness of your problems, which is what we're going to do tomorrow morning in the meditation, Mahamudra meditation, okay? We use a problem. In meditation, it's, how come my meditations aren't good enough, you know? How come I can't meditate, you know? I've been trying for years, and nothing's happening. You know, how come I can't do it? It's the same with the boss thing. How come he came in and yelled at you? Because you yelled at somebody in the past. Okay, so then you have to apply the same principles to your meditation. It doesn't matter how you sit, mainly. It doesn't matter, you know, think about this, think about that. It's mainly what Jetsun Kapa said in a famous letter to his student, Lao Dakpa, Sako Umbo. He said, get your act together morally. You know, get your act together with your vows. And that's how you get your meditation to take off. Because that has this karmic effect on your ability to concentrate. Okay, you keep your vows, suddenly you're able to concentrate. Because the concentration itself is a projection. Okay? That's why. It's just a karmic projection. It's really cool. Okay? See, that's how you do the emptiness of the mental. Glad you asked. Okay? Sorry. Okay, last one. Say Shiram. Shiram. Shiram is wisdom, the perfection of wisdom. Okay. I see somebody thinking about the emptiness of the wisdom perfection. Maybe? Okay, anyway. Shiram. Shiram is, there's a lot of kinds of Shiram. I mean, Shiram can mean understanding future lives. Shiram can mean understanding karma. Obviously, the most important Shiram is seeing emptiness directly. Okay. I thought I'd give you the definition of Vipassana. Okay. Vipassana is the Sanskrit, the Pali is Vipassana, okay? And it's been used to describe a kind of meditation nowadays, but the real old meaning, the traditional meaning, is as the brother to Shamatha, okay? The other half of, Shamatha is the platform or the ability to concentrate that you need to reach before you can see emptiness directly. And then you need the ability to analyze the object and to see its emptiness, okay? And that's the traditional, that's the ancient meaning of Vipassana, okay? So those are the distinctions. Shamatha is a form of concentration. Vipassana is a kind of analysis of the object whereby you find emptiness, okay? And I'm going to give you the traditional definition of it, okay? Very slowly. That wisdom, which is full of the exceptional bliss, and I'm going to say that comes from practice, okay? Meditation practice. By power of the analysis of its object. And then there's another thing that says it has to be founded upon shamatha, okay? Those are the qualities. It has to be based on shamatha. The platform is shamatha. Shamatha you can think of as almost a neutral thing. It's the ability to concentrate to a deep level. And then Vipassana, in its traditional presentation, is the ability to analyze the object for its emptiness. to try to find the emptiness of the object, okay? Somebody else asked me, and it was the last question on the homework yesterday, and you missed it. I didn't get to it yesterday, okay? Sorry. When I used to work in the diamond business, I used to get phone calls the next morning, like 30 phone calls, you know. You didn't cover that in class. I'm going to talk a little bit about the meaning of self, okay? People ask me about what does self mean, okay? Say doc. Doc. Okay. Well, you know, I think, I mean, I went through all the same problems you went through. I showed up in Dharamsala, I didn't know a thing. You know, people were prostrating, I refused, you know. I didn't know what they were doing, you know. And I had no idea about anything. I mean, I just went there without knowing a single thing about Buddhism. Then they start talking about no self, you know. And I'm looking, you know, I'm meditating, trying to figure out where Michael Roach went, you know. And you know, it was very frustrating. It was really frustrating. You know, I went year after year getting different explanations, going to different lamas, reading different texts, learning, struggling to learn Tibetan so I could try to get to the text myself, and trying to figure out what the hell they're talking about when there's no self, okay? Obviously, there's somebody brushing his teeth in my mirror in the morning, okay? And somebody there, that's dark, that's self, you know? And then the lama starts talking about the self of the pen. You know, and then I'm like, I understand herself, his self, but pen self, I, you know, what are you talking about, you know? And what does self mean, okay? Basically, it's like this, okay? Imagine, and I told you before, an elephant suddenly breaks into the front gate past those capable policemen, rushes in. It's purple. It's 40 feet high. It has two long necks like a brontosaurus. And it's crushing all the people in this room right now. At this moment, okay, what's the status of that elephant? Does that exist or not? I mean, first of all, you know, you look around and you say, no, it doesn't exist, you know. And then, but in the back of your mind, I mean, I didn't see a lot of people turn around. You know, it wasn't like people were checking in the back to see if one had suddenly showed up and was on their way to squash them. You know what I mean? You just sat there. Because, you know, if I said there's a snake in the room or something, then people might have looked, you know, but I'm describing something which you know to not exist. You already know that doesn't exist, so you're not nervous about this elephant. You know, nobody got, you know, uptight about the elephant. The dog has the same existence as that, okay? Your troubles, your mental problems, your physical problems, all the way up to aging and death, the death process itself, the fact that your body ages, the fact that you may have to die, is caused by believing in a thing that never existed, could not exist, will not exist, and you believe in it, and you think you see it all day long. Every single perception you ever have is tainted by this belief, okay? That's dark. Dark is a pen that comes from its own side. Is there such a thing? Am I not holding up a pen which is coming from its own side? By the way, tonight, don't miss tonight, okay? We're going to talk about tsurtong. Tsurtong means people who think it's coming this way. It's a word in Tibetan Buddhism for somebody who hasn't seen emptiness directly. Tsurtong means they think the pen is coming this way. And you feel that. Deep in your heart, you feel it. You know, you can sit here, I can explain intellectually about emptiness, but deep in your heart, you really believe that's a pen from its own side. And I say to you again, and you have to hear it about 500 hours worth of this, okay, and I'm not kidding. It's a white and black cylinder. Your past karma is forcing your mind to organize that white and black cylinder into a pen. And if you didn't have that karma, you'd be organizing it into something to chew on, okay? And then you'd be a dog. And I repeat again and try to get it, okay? It's not that you see it as something to chew on because you're a dog. It's that you're a dog because you see it as something to chew on. And that's what makes you a dog. And that's why it's easy to take a rebirth as a dog. Okay? Because things are empty. Okay? The rebirth stuff becomes frightening when you understand emptiness. Okay? this could just as well for you to be by tomorrow morning something to chew on, and then they'd be kicking you out of the back of here. You know what I mean? Okay, all right, I'm not kidding. It's just a perception. Taking a rebirth is not like you got to go somewhere else or something like that. It's a small shift in the perception. It's the same shift in perceptions that makes a pen run out of ink. It's the same shift in perceptions that makes a glass of tea become empty. You see what I mean? It's no more big deal than that. You could be a dog as easy as this pen can run out of ink. You see what I mean? It's dangerous. It's frightening. You see what I mean? You got to work on it now, okay? And that's the emptiness of this pen. You have to understand that's the dot, okay? A pen which could come from its own side, the way your mind is whispering to you all the time, it must be, doesn't exist, never could exist, never did exist, never will exist. It just ain't there. That's dot, okay? I prefer to translate it as self-nature, okay? I think the translation as self is very dangerous and very liable to misunderstanding, okay? There's a thing called yu gi dot and megi dot. Say yu gi dot. Yu gi dot. Yu gi dot means the self which does exist. Michael Roach exists, he's standing up here, he's talking to you, you're understanding something, hopefully. Okay? And then there's a megi dot. Megi dot means the Michael Roach which isn't standing up here, and the Michael Roach which doesn't exist, and the Michael Roach which never existed. And that's the one that comes from his own side, okay? If you're understanding emptiness today or this week, it's because you have the karma to interpret my words that way. Somebody had a big debate with Arya Nagarjuna. Somebody came up to Nagarjuna and said, are you telling me everything's empty? He says, yes. Are you saying that my perceptions make everything what it is? He says, right. Then he says, then how come I can understand you telling me that? Okay? Okay? It's a great question. If your words don't have their own existence, then how can I understand you telling me they don't have any existence? You say, Nagarjuna says, you're right, they don't. Half the time when I give this talk, people go. People fall asleep. People get bored. You know, people don't get it at all. Okay? They don't have the karma to interpret those same sounds as a good teaching on emptiness. You see what I mean? Not even words have their own dot. Okay? Self-nature. Not even words have meanings of their own that you can understand without your karma piecing it together and making it worse, okay? I can't even teach you emptiness, unless your mind has enough incredibly powerful virtue to understand what I'm saying about emptiness, okay? That's the emptiness of a teaching on emptiness, okay? It's a dot. Is there a dot? Okay, in the monastery, dot made nature. You start, when you want to start a fight in the monastery, you start by saying something crazy. Ready? Dot made nature, okay? Ima, that made an intern. No such thing as a self. Dayata, you tell me there is such a thing as a self? Shut! Show me, what the hell? I'm right here, he said. Then you gotta go, fa! Tell me it's gacha. Okay? Yeah, you're sitting there. There's a self. Self made, okay? Alright. Maybe you got you an intern. So, does that doc which doesn't exist exist? No, no, it doesn't. Nada. You tell me the doctor doesn't exist? Yeah, so. Show me a doctor that doesn't exist. Yeah, what? A pen that comes from its own side. That's all. So that means self-nature. Okay, that's all. An Atman. Yeah, there is no self. It doesn't mean there's no Michael Roach. And the word self doesn't only apply to people. Forget all that, okay? It means self-nature. Ramshin Mepa. Does it have any nature of its own? No. Okay? It doesn't have any nature of being a pen of its own. Okay? Does it have a nature of being pen? Yes. Where does it come from? Your mind. Where did that come from? Your karma is forcing you to see it as a pen. That's all. Okay? It does have a nature of being a pen. But it doesn't have its own nature of being a pen. Got the difference? It's okay? It has a nature of being a pen that you're putting onto it. It doesn't have a nature of being a pen from its own side, or else the dogs will come up and write with it. Okay? That's all. Did you have a question?
At a certain age, the baby human seems very similar to a dog.
Yeah.
Also, that's right.
Yeah. Like at a certain point in a child's development, they can only perceive it almost the equivalent of a dog, the way a dog perceives it. Then later on in their development, they can see it as a pen. Okay. In other words, oftentimes when I teach this thing about the pen, they say, well, I perceive it as a pen because my mother explained to me the use of a pen, and therefore I see it as a pen. You see what I mean? Now go and try to explain that to a dog. You see what I mean? If there's some kind of pen that's coming from it which you can recognize after being taught that it's a pen by your mother, then attempt to teach that to a dog and see if they can then see it after a pen after some training. You see what I mean? It's called, there's a word for it in the Dajangba. It's a very rare word in Majimika. It means a person who is familiar with the concept. Dajangba Kyebu means a person who's been introduced to the concept that it's a pen and therefore knows it's a pen. That's also a projection. Get it? That's also a projection. The fact that you had a mother, the fact that you perceive her as your mother, the fact that you understood the meaning of the words they said and got introduced to it as a pen and then observed it, recognized it as a pen, is just another projection. Okay, you got to get used to that. You got to get used to it. It's a very interesting question. That's why there's some retarded people who can't cognize it as a pen. By the way, the karma to see it as a pen can wear out before you die. I read a description of Ronald Reagan, ex-president of the United States. Used to have his finger on the entire world's destruction, you know. And they said he went by an aquarium recently, a fish bowl, and there was the fish was swimming around this little plastic White House. You gotta get used to it. It's a very interesting question. That's why there's some retarded people who can't cognize it as a pen. By the way, the karma to see it as a pen can wear out before you die. I read a description of Ronald Reagan, ex-president of the United States, used to have his finger on the entire world's destruction, you know. And they said he went by an aquarium recently, a fish bowl, and there was the fish was swimming around this little plastic White House, and he stopped, and he was staring at it, you know. And they said, President Reagan, you know, what are you doing? And he says, that thing in the middle, that plastic thing, you know, he says, it used to mean something to me. You know, it's important. Something there. You see, he's senile now. He's got Alzheimer's. He can't remember what the White House was. You see what I mean? What's happening karmically? It's wearing out. You see, the karma to be able to cognize that object as, or even the White House, is he's losing it. It wore out. You see, that's the nasty thing about karma. It wears out. Okay, if you don't do it with an understanding of emptiness and compassion, then it wears out. Okay, and you'd be like Reagan. Okay, all right. Let me see if there's anything I didn't cover. Oh, the question yesterday said difference between self, living being, something alive, and a person, okay? Self, and this repeats itself throughout the sutra. Throughout the sutra, Lord Buddha says, nothing has a self, nothing has a living being, nothing is something alive, and nothing is a person. These are all synonyms, okay? And don't forget they don't just apply to people. He's just using the word self to apply to objects also, okay? This doesn't have any self nature. In a sense, it's not a person of a pen itself, or something like that. They're just all synonyms for a thing which could exist from its own side. Particularly people, but it also applies to other objects, okay? A nature of existing from its own side. A penness which can come from its own side. There are many, many synonyms for that. Sometimes it's called the self-nature of the pen. Sometimes it's called its own nature. Sometimes it's called its existing by definition. Sometimes it's called its persona, its living, it's being a living being. Those are all synonyms in this sutra for a pen which could come from its own side, as they don't exist. Okay? Technically, when he talks about no self, he's talking about no Michael Roach. When he talks about no living being, he's talking about no Michael Roach's arm from its own side. When he talks about nothing that's alive, he's talking about no Michael Roach from the day he was born to the day he died. And when he says no person, he's talking about no Michael Roach who takes rebirth. Okay? From its own side. You always have to say from its own side. Okay? Let me see if I left out. How are we doing on time? $5. Okay, I think I got one more question here. Hang on. Tell you what, save the last two questions for the next class. Okay, I'll tell you what they are and then we'll talk about them next time. Explain why Buddha said that the perfections done without an understanding of emptiness did not deserve the name of perfection. This is a very famous thing. It says, Paratu Chimbe Ming Mitong. Then, explain how the first five perfections and the last one act as causes for each other. That's that frustrating thing where the Lama says, you've got to have an understanding of emptiness or you're not doing the perfections. And then you say, well, how do I get that understanding? They say, do the first five perfections. You know, you're like, okay. No, it used to drive me crazy, you know. Okay, we'll talk about that. The one question I will answer for you now is, there's a debate in the scripture about karma, okay? How does karma stay in your mind? Does karma exist? You see, I mean, like, we shouldn't do that now. It's too much. It's too much. It's too much before a break. But, I'll give you a taste, okay? I'll do what my Lama always does. He leaves you with a question, okay? Are the laws of karma themselves a projection? Okay? Is the fact that when you do something kind to someone, you get a good result later, also a projection? That law, you see, I'm talking about the law itself. Okay? And doesn't that imply that it could be just the opposite if you had the karma for it to be? Matthew's favorite question. You know, doesn't that imply that if you had worse karma, that maybe a good deed would result in a bad result or something like that? You see what I mean? Do these rules, do these principles about emptiness and karma apply to the laws of karma themselves? Okay? And that's something we'll talk about. Okay? It's too much to do, just so skip that question too. One small question. Emptiness or is there? I knew you'd figure out that. The one thing I want to say about that is this. The specific karma which produces in you the perception in your own mind, the perception of your own mind as understanding emptiness. Okay? What is that karma? You mean we're all interested, right? Like, I would like to understand emptiness. And you say it's a projection. And you say even my thoughts are projections. You say even my thoughts are just mental sounds that my mind is organizing into what we call understanding emptiness. So just tell me the karma, how to get that. You know, what's the karma for me to see my own mind as understanding emptiness? Okay, and the answer is that worldview begets worldview. Okay, karmically. Worldview begets worldview. Meaning, the karma to understand emptiness is to understand emptiness. Oh boy, then there's no hope. Right? I mean, why do I call it worldview? This is a whole new way of seeing your world. If you understand this course, then by the time you get out of this course, your behavior should be fundamentally different. Okay? For example, if you're in a company, which I was, vice president of a huge corporation, okay? And you want that corporation to be successful. For example, if you own General Motors and you want to sell more cars, then what is the one single karma that would sell the most cars? Give away as many as you can. Now, suppose the whole world operated on this thing. I mean, that's a radically different worldview, okay? How would you act towards your competition if you wanted to be successful? In this worldview, this new worldview, help them. Okay, don't try to hurt Chrysler. Bail them out when they're in trouble, and you'll sell more cars. You see what I mean? I mean, you laugh because it sounds crazy. You see what I mean? Yeah, sell more cars by giving away more cars to poor people in India. You know, ship 10,000 cars to Bombay. Calcutta is better, and give them away. You know, and watch your sales go through the roof. You know what I mean? I mean, imagine a corporation being run by this worldview. You know what I mean? That is the implication of what I'm teaching. If what I'm saying is correct, then the most intelligent way to run your business, a major corporation, would be to do this. You see what I mean? And I do, and it works. Okay? I mean, nobody can say it didn't work. You know, $100 million a year of sales. Period. I mean, Forbes magazine, frankly, came and said, how the hell did you do that? You know? And they, you know, they wrote a little, it got a long article, didn't it? Wall Street Journal came a couple weeks ago and said, how the hell did you do that? You know? And it's worldview. Now, unfortunately, the karma to get that kind of worldview is to already to have some of it. Okay? And that's why they have that thing in Scripture about the turtle coming up every 500 years and sticking his head through an inner tube that's floating around the Pacific Ocean. And, you know, that's why it's so hard to get here today. That's why karmically, for you to be here is really difficult. That's why so many people are sick, by the way. Okay? To get here, to understand what I'm saying, to be on the verge of accepting that idea that you should give away cars to boost the company's sales, you know what I mean? It's very difficult. It's you have to be almost ready to see it already, and that means you have to have already the karma to think this way. You see what I mean? Which you do or you wouldn't be here. You'd already have left, actually. Okay. It's kind of embarrassing in the front row to get out, but not in the back row. Okay. So anyway, unfortunately, worldview-wise, you have to go after it and destroy it, you know? How do I get rid of this person in this Dharma group that drives me crazy, you know? Can we find a way to get this person out of our group, you know? Can we find a nice way, a nice Buddhist way, to get this person out of our Dharma center? They are just too much, you know what I mean? And then, the minute you start thinking violence or do something to them, or get them, or then you're spitting on this worldview. You see what I mean? And then the karma of that is that you won't get it tomorrow either. You see what I mean? Unfortunately, the karma of understanding emptiness comes from understanding emptiness. And every time you have an opposite worldview, every time you think you can get rid of somebody by firing them, I mean, if you've ever been a manager, the minute you fire them, you hire another guy, it turns out the same. You know what I mean? Or the minute you quit a place because you don't like it, the same people show up at your new job to torture you the same way, you know? It's because they're not coming from outside, they're coming from karma, okay? Anyway, you gotta, on the one hand, be careful to cultivate this worldview, but I think even more importantly, every time you start to have a violent or a negative reaction to somebody, what's the barometer of a mental affliction? You see, the stronger your mental affliction, then by definition, your worldview is screwed up. You see? Anger, jealousy, pride, desire, etc. are barometers of your understanding of emptiness. If you have a lot of bad thoughts, if you have a lot of strong negative emotions, that's a definite sign that you're not understanding your world. You see what I mean? That'll give you a clue. Every time you start to feel strongly about something, stop, because you're having the wrong worldview. And then you won't be able to understand emptiness a week later. It'll ruin your karma. You see what I mean? Okay. We'll stop. We'll start 1 hour from now. I don't know what time it is by now, but it's okay. We'll do some prayers. Yeah. Yeah.
Sise bardu ten gyur.